Good morning and welcome to the January 20th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
Today, the nation celebrates the birth of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. While much of King's legacy is associated with political rights, Dr. King was very much focused on economic justice as well. Indeed, the I Have a Dream speech was delivered at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. So, it seems appropriate on this day to reflect on the way that political and economic rights have been intertwined since Reconstruction. We're lucky to be able to welcome back to the program Professor Justine Hill Edwards of the University of Virginia. Good morning, Professor Edwards, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
Professor Edwards, the major civil rights bills were passed in the mid-1960s, some 60 years ago. So can we start with a bit of an overview on racial differences in terms of income and wealth then and now?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it is amazing and great that we're having a conversation today about the intertwining of kind of political and economic rights, because for many of the civil rights movement, these two ideas were, again, tightly connected and, as you said, tightly intertwined. But I think we can say that, unfortunately, economic rights has really not been as much of a priority as perhaps Dr. King may have wanted in the 60s. And so the racial wealth gap, for example, has stayed pretty steady. It's ebbed and flowed over the past 60 years, but I mean, increasingly, it has stayed the same. So, for example, in the 1980s, the median family wealth of white households was about $129,000. And for non-white households, mostly Black and Hispanics, that number is 16,000. And that was in 1983. And so if we go to really the 2020s, 2022, for example, the average, the median wealth of white families was about $284,000. And the median wealth of Black families was about $44,000. And so we still continue to see this racial wealth gap, especially in terms of race, but income as well, being persistent in American society.
You've posited that the vestiges of today's inequality can be traced to the slaveholding era. What's the best way to characterize the relationship between slavery and capitalism?
Well, this has been, I think, a really robust and sometimes contentious debate among historians, among economists. But I think it is clear that the history of slavery and the history of capitalism in the United States are connected and are intertwined. I mean, I think if we think about the history of banking, for example, or the history of insurance, those two industries were tightly intertwined with the success of slave-produced cotton and the profits that slave traders and enslavers made from selling their enslaved property. And so the idea that we can understand American capitalism without understanding its vestiges in slavery, I think, is a bit misguided, because understanding those two ideas, especially at its core, the idea of exploitation, is incredibly important.
So let's take a look at Reconstruction. What are some of the ways that the government policies during Reconstruction, how did that affect income and wealth inequality?
Sure. Well, Reconstruction is such an important period in American history for studying the ways that the connectedness of race and wealth has evolved for American history. Of course, this is the first period of freedom, marking really 1865 to 1877. And this is a period when the almost 4 million recently emancipated African Americans really were tasting freedom in meaningful ways for the first time. And so they were negotiating labor contracts. The Freedmen's Bureau was an important institution that was kind of mediating between recently emancipated African Americans and white employers. And so we start to see African Americans start to buy land, start to save money. In my book, Savings and Trust, I talk quite a bit about this, about the Freedmen's Bank as a vehicle to help the recently emancipated save money. This is a period of time when African Americans are really understanding what economic and political rights mean for themselves and their families, especially in terms of owning property. And so this is a fundamental period for understanding the relationship between African Americans, the federal government, and really how African Americans thought about themselves as now active participants in American economic life without the yoke of slavery.
And it seems like there's a two steps forward, three steps back phenomenon that goes on between early and middle Reconstruction. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there were massive expansions in African Americans' ability to open schools. Literacy rates were increasing. African Americans, again, were starting to buy land and investing in wealth in land. But that quickly turns around. I mean, Reconstruction ends officially in 1877 with the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, and the federal government really makes a step back in terms of not protecting the economic and political rights of African Americans. And so it was this very short period of time when we see this quick expansion of rights with the Reconstruction Amendments, of course, but a quick retrenchment with the federal government really taking a step back from protecting the rights of the recently emancipated.
And once those rights weren't protected, what did we see happen?
We see what historians of this period, well, really historians of African American history, what we call the nadir of race relations. We see the expansion of terrorist organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan. We see African Americans being shuffled into predatory employment relationships, the emergence of sharecropping in the South, for example. And we see the strategic divestment of land from African Americans who had purchased land, again, during the period of Reconstruction. We see exploitative taxation policies in states like Virginia. And so, yes, we can say that this period, what historians will often call the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, the expansion of big business, but at its core, we see the expansion of a different type of exploitation, and African Americans were experiencing that exploitation quite acutely.
So in 1935, they passed the Social Security Act. To what extent did the provisions of the act have a disparate economic impact based on race?
Sure. Well, Roosevelt signed this act in 1935 as a part of the New Deal, right? Mm-hmm. The expansion of a social safety net for African Americans. And fundamentally, it was designed to protect the nation's elderly and unemployed, especially in old age. And it was actually called old age insurance. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, most African American workers didn't qualify for Social Security because it did not apply to the nation's domestic workers and agricultural workers. And these were two sectors that were highly populated by African Americans, especially in the South. And around this time, really in 1930, about 65% of African Americans held these jobs. And so they were at first disproportionately not eligible for Social Security. And so we see this as being a major factor in how African Americans were kind of contributing to economic growth in this period, but really not benefiting from the federal government's protection.
You know, does a review of the legislative history surrounding the Social Security Act, is there any sort of indication that this was a deliberate aspect of the way the act was structured?
Sure, and there historians have come to several estimations about why this happened. Some believe that there were members of Congress from the South who were protecting the economic interests of those who owned these kind of larger plantations on which African Americans were working as sharecroppers, and so wanting to protect their economic interests above the interests of Black workers. There are others that believe that this was kind of not done intentionally, but was kind of a de facto offshoot of this broader piece of the legislation. But whatever the cause, it was clear that it did not, and that lawmakers did not fully account for the ways in which African Americans would need this old age insurance, especially as they were working in these demanding jobs that weren't covered by this piece of legislation.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier in the interview, and that is, you know, during that post-Reconstruction period, you talked about taxation policies having differential impacts. Can you explain a little bit about what you meant there?
Sure. Well, there are historians. One of my colleagues, too, at the University of Virginia has published a really great book, Drew Carl. His book, The Black Tax, looks at this specifically. But this was done kind of on a state-by-state basis, where states would create disparate taxation policies and implement taxation policies differently based on the race of the property owners. And so African Americans who own property would be strategically strategically taxed at higher rates than their white counterparts. And these racially disparate taxation policies chipped away and drained wealth from African Americans who were investing in the American dream of property ownership. And so when this happens over generations, we see wealth being drained from African Americans who were investing and hoping to pass on wealth to their descendants, and couldn't do so at the same rates as their white counterparts.
Did they do that by, like, taking maps and saying this part of the county gets taxed at a higher rate? How did they do it?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, they did it in terms of figuring out where African Americans were segregated, right? Mm-hmm. We are talking about regions where housing segregation was rampant, and imposing just a different set of taxation policies. And this was done because we're talking about states doing this on kind of a county by county level, tax assessors strategically overvaluing Black property, but African Americans actually not financially benefiting from those valuations, but being overly taxed, and taxing livestock differently, taxing machinery in different ways. And so we're talking about this being a very strategic effort to strip African Americans of wealth.
Now, did the counties or states have any kind of justification that they had to prove to the state or the county itself on how they changed this taxation?
No.
Wow.
No, I mean, this was so kind of institutionalized. And again, we're not talking about kind of Black property assessors, right? We are talking about African-Americans being forced to pay taxes in order to maintain their properties, but having few legal recourses to fight and push back.
And did this result in tax sales? You know, they couldn't pay their taxes, and the county took it, and the sheriff did a sale on it?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. And so this is, we see the kind of major divestment of land and property from African Americans who were just simply unable to pay taxes on their property because of their higher tax rates.
You know, there's a line that you can draw from this kind of phenomenon to other kinds of real estate-related government policies that happened in the 20th century. So and this is kind of a segue we could turn to the GI Bill, which was passed in 1944, and it had a huge impact on the attainability of education and homes for returning servicemen. How did the implementation of the act have a disparate impact on race?
Sure. Well, African Americans were fighting in World War II and coming back home and experiencing increasing levels of racial violence. And so with the creation of the GI Bill in 1944, we see this expansion of the American middle class, right? White veterans coming back home, getting access to low-interest mortgages to low-interest business loans, getting aid to attend the nation's colleges and universities. But disproportionately, African Americans were left out of access to these really important pieces of legislation that, again, expanded the American middle class. If we talk about access to low-interest mortgages, we are talking about the 1940s, a period of time when redlining was still alive and well. And again, redlining is a practice where maps were marked in terms of race to characterize to banks or to show banks the risk of lending to homeowners in particular communities. And these communities tended to be communities of color. And so even though the VA was not extending loans, they were guaranteeing loans. And African Americans could not get these loans disproportionately. And we're talking about neighborhoods, too, with racial covenants, where African Americans could not legally buy in certain neighborhoods. And so they were increasingly pushed out of the dream of home ownership through their connections to the VA and the GI Bill. We can talk about the expansion of higher education in colleges and universities, right? African Americans were not allowed and granted access to many of these institutions of higher education. Yes, we did have historically Black colleges and universities that actually emerged during the 19th century and expanded during the period of Reconstruction, but these institutions were disproportionately underfunded and did not have the infrastructure to support the massive influx of Black veterans who wanted to access higher education. And so we see African Americans, yes, making strides into the middle class in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, but not at the same rate as their white counterparts because of these, because of the persistence of racial segregation.
So were Black veterans able to use GI Bill benefits to attend HBCUs, or were they precluded?
They could, mm-hmm. but increasingly, though, I mean, HBCUs, again, were underfunded and, sure. and essentially didn't have the types of programs in terms of baccalaureate degrees or even graduate degrees that their white counterparts had access to. And, I mean, African-American soldiers disproportionately did not have access to not higher education, but kind of elementary school education, high school education. And so they were enrolling, they were in the military with kind of less education in general because of racial segregation in our education system. And so the fact that, yes, HBCUs did experience this influx, but they just did not have the type of infrastructure because of generations of underfunding that their white counterparts did.
You know, everyone perceives, and I think rightfully so, the GI Bill and the sort of massive increase in home ownership associated with the post-war period as having had a major effect on sort of obviously on home ownership in this country and its derivative mm-hmm. wealth. How big a distinction do you think, how big a deal do you think this distinction is? How much did it impact that disparity in wealth? Black veterans were just not given the opportunity to get that home.
Sure. Well, I mean, there was a study published recently by researchers at Brandeis, and they found that the descendants of white veterans kind of gained financial benefits that amounted to almost $60,000. Alternatively, the descendants of Black veterans gained financial benefits that equated to only about $23,000. And so if we think about home ownership, if we think about the creation of small businesses, if we think about access to higher education, that access had real financial benefits. And there were fundamentally disparities between the benefits that African Americans gained and the benefits financially that the families of white vets gained.
And that moves across generations. So there's an intergenerational mm-hmm. lack of wealth because
Absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely.
I want to touch a little more on post-war government mortgage programs and how there was, again, significant racial impact. Obviously, a lot of home ownership was facilitated by various federal mortgage programs. Again, how were those administered in ways that had a disproportionate racial impact?
Sure. Well, on the one hand, again, in the first half of the 20th century, we had redlining,
right,
which disallowed African Americans from being able to invest in the financial benefits of home ownership. Into the 1970s and 1980s, we have what one scholar calls predatory inclusion. And so while African Americans could get loans because of the Fair Housing Act, for example, and the Community Reinvestment Act of 1968 and 1977, respectively, African Americans were kind of shuffled into higher interest mortgages, which again means, of course, that they were paying more to invest in home ownership. And so by paying more interest rates in fees, this meant that African Americans were disproportionately not gaining the financial benefits of investing in home ownership in the same ways as their white counterparts. And so we see this, again, compound and extend into the 1980s and 1990s in terms of African Americans' financial ability to invest in the vehicles of wealth accumulation that we all accept as being fundamental in this country.
I know a topic that you're particularly interested in is access to financial institutions. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the lack of access and how that impacts Black financial health?
Sure. Well, at the end of last year, really in October, the Treasury published the National Strategy for Financial Inclusion in the U.S., and it is a really interesting report that offers a proposal for remedying the problem of financial inclusion that that economists, that historians, that sociologists see as being fundamental and a fundamental hurdle to addressing the racial wealth gap. And so the idea that financial inclusion, by offering a robust set of financial services to communities that historically been unbanked, underbanked, is an important part of addressing the racial wealth gap. And that goes to the issue of trust, a topic that I think is so important. If we look at the history of the kind of predatory relationship between communities of color and the financial services industry in this country, we see fundamentally it is a problem of exploitation, perhaps, but also a problem of trust on the part of consumers. And so bringing together financial institutions and communities of color, especially communities that have been historically pushed out of the traditional financial services industry, is incredibly important. And so kind of coming to terms with this history and addressing these historical wrongs, I think, is important to addressing this trust gap, to go to addressing this problem of financial inclusion that many communities of color feel today and have continued to feel throughout American history.
Boy, it's not really easy to wave a wand and create trust, is it?
No. No, it's not.
So what steps should be taken to try to create that trust?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think being very clear about what communities of color need. I think financial institutions need to understand what communities of color and historically disadvantaged communities need. They need access to simple financial services. They need access to credit and vehicles to create credit. They need to address kind of barriers to property ownership, to investing in their own communities. I think community-based banks are a great vehicle for this. And so I think, again, kind of having a sense of why trust is not there on the part of consumers is important for banks and other financial institutions, because not understanding that, I think, is perhaps a problem that they have underestimated for far too long.
So that we need a revisit to the Freedmen's Bank.
Bringing it back, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
absolutely. I mean, and I think it is the history of the Freedmen's Bank, it was a period in time, but I think it's so instructive for helping us understand why these conversations continue to pop up in American history, because it does have a history. And I think that the Freedmen's Bank is in some ways at its core and at its mm-hmm. foundation.
And just to remind our listeners, we previously did an interview with Professor Edwards about her book, The Freedmen's Bank. I want to circle back as we come to an end to Dr. King. What were Dr. King's views on the state of economic justice and the role of government in addressing poverty?
Sure. Well, I think perhaps the public underestimates the extent to which Dr. King's language, especially towards the end of his life, had really begun to incorporate the ideas of economic justice and encouraging Americans and the federal government to address issues of poverty. He equated addressing poverty to addressing a major facet of expanding civil rights. And he actually said this in 1966. He published this in the Nation, and I'm just going to read a little bit because I think it's really fascinating. He wrote, "Our nation is now so rich, so productive, that the continuation of persistent poverty is incendiary because the poor cannot rationalize their deprivation. We have yet to confront and solve the international problems created by our wealth in a world still largely hungry and miserable. But more immediate and pressing is the domestic existence of poverty. It is an anachronism in the second half of the 20th century. Only the neglect to plan intelligently and adequately and the unwillingness to genuinely embrace economic justice enable it to persist." And so I think it's such, I think, a clear reflection, especially on this day of remembrance for King's birthday, and interestingly enough, too, the day of the inauguration, to remember the importance of economic justice in our hopefully embrace of civil rights for all Americans.
And that, it seems, is a wonderful way to conclude the interview. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you again for having me. It's been fun.
The news stories surrounding the patroller's strike and conditions at Park City Mountain during the holidays were everywhere. There's no question that the 2024 holidays left a black mark on the reputation of the resort, on Vail, and probably on the town as a destination itself. So what, in the first instance, could Vail and the resort have done better in terms of handling the situation? And more importantly, what kind of damage can a situation like this do to the various brands at issue, the Park City Resort, Vail, and the town itself? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Professor Paul Argenti of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, the man who literally wrote the textbook, Corporate Communication. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, we could start with the beginning of the strike on December 27th, but do you have any observations about how Vail and Park City handled things in the run-up?
Yes, I think they did a pretty bad job, to be honest with you. I mean, for one thing, you know this is coming. It is what I would describe as kind of a predictable surprise for a company. And given that that's the case, you know, your communications should be much more transparent and honest, and you know, you need to have open communication channels. And instead, from what I could see, there isn't a whole lot of communication out there. The only thing that they did was to stress that, you know, wages have increased more than 50%, which, as someone who comes out there in the winter, you know, with my family for skiing, that is appalling. That means they were paying $12 an hour to the people who literally save your life. So I don't think the communications ahead of time did them any good. Let's put it that way.
And are there strategies that they could have employed that you've seen other companies who see something ugly coming have done? Is there a way to have done it better?
Yeah. I mean, let me tell you something. Union communications is not like something new for people to learn. It's something that you could plan for. And as I like to say to my students, these kinds of problems do not have to happen. The best way to prevent this is never to let it happen in the first place. and some good examples, and I was trying to think of examples in the hospitality industry for you. Last year, you know, Hilton Hawaiian Village had a whole contract negotiation, and the village successfully concluded a strike by ratifying a new contract. And throughout that process, I'd say Hilton did a really good job of engaging in dialogue with union reps, keeping employees informed about the developments. And that kind of proactive strategy really helps to reach an agreement down the road. San Francisco hotels, I spend a lot of time in San Francisco, so I was aware of this. At the end of the year, a lot of hotels, including Hilton, Marriott, and Hyatt, were involved in labor negotiations. And they employed good communication strategies with public statements, outlining their positions, what they're doing to make it happen. And then we could go back, you know, this goes on and on, like Marriott, 2018. I think this kind of communication is one that you could get right pretty easily. You know, it's not that complicated.
And so what should they have been saying? Give us a hypothetical press release that Vail should have put out in early December to sort of let the public know what might be coming.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, they should say, you know, we want to do everything we possibly can to make these people happy and to try to reach an agreement that makes sense for us and for them. And we are bargaining in good faith and doing the best that we possibly can to make sure there's no disruption on the mountain and that our employees feel happy to work for us. Something along those lines, like a sign of good faith. Instead, at least from what I've read, you know, and this could be the association making stuff up, but I doubt it, that they instead threatened retaliatory measures against striking employees, including deactivating passes, threatening eviction, ending dependent employee programs, cutting health benefits, locker room access, terminating daycare services. You know, this isn't the way that you treat people. And if, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. If that was in the air, that probably was the kind of communication they were getting from people in management.
That's who the patrollers were getting? That's the information the patrollers were getting?
No, that's the kind of information, yeah, that the public was getting.
The public, yeah. About how they were treating the union and the patrollers. Gotcha.
And again, if you're planning, there's an expression in town of the $10,000 or the $20,000 vacation. You know, we're in early December. The people that plan these vacations, they don't have any information about what's coming. So I guess part of what happened here was the surprise for the vacationer.
Yes, in fact, and that's a really important point, that they could have easily written to people and said, you know, we are going through a tough situation, both in terms of the snow and the work, you know, the union negotiations, and you should be prepared for this. We're happy to give you refunds. I mean, I know they would have taken a financial hit, but actually the benefit of that would have made up for any financial hit that they would have taken from that. And I think, you know, it strikes me that their lack of communication since then, and particularly given that there are some lawsuits from people who were upset about what happened, show that they're adopting a more legal strategy and still not realizing how important it is to, you know, get to the bottom of this and try to make things right with your employees.
You know, given how many, I don't know how attuned you are to the way that Vail approaches its pass sales. They sell, obviously, you know, thousands of season passes under the Epic Pass program that are good at many resorts. One of the things I was wondering why they didn't do was send out something that say, hey, we may be having a problem at Park City, but we can happily accommodate you at any of these other fine resorts in North America.
Exactly. I mean, had they any kind of communication strategy or any sense of what good communications to customers is all about, they would have done that. And, you know, the problem is at this point you have a duopoly, you know, in the industry, and, you know, they just don't care as much about trying to please customers in the way that they should. I mean, going there myself, it is super expensive to go there. I think one of the picketers had a sign that said, you know, you pay $25 for a hamburger and you're worried about spending $23 for the people who are going to save your life on the mountain, which is absolutely true and heartbreaking. It's ridiculous that this company didn't handle this better. It's ridiculous that they didn't take the time to try to figure out how to make sure that their customers were taken care of. And at this point, I have to say, you know, given that there is another pass, like there's at least one other choice out there, I think a lot of people are going to make that decision. You know, I mean, maybe they're just as bad. But right now, I think there's a pretty bad taste in everyone's mouth about Vail.
So do you think skiers will let their Vail pass go away and get a pass from one of the other mountains and plan a different kind of vacation next year?
I don't see why not. I mean, for us, we can ski, you know, anywhere in the Northeast and anywhere out there. Like, why do you have to be locked into Epic? You know, I mean, it was a great deal because there are mountains here that are also Epic mountains. But if they're going to treat people like this, you have to think twice about whether you want to do business with people who operate this way.
So once the strike began, and we know the conditions on the mountain were difficult, not only because of the strike, but lack of snow, what is your view of the communication strategy deployed by Vail, or lack thereof, at that time?
Yeah, I don't think they had any communications that I could find, except, you know, the leaked communications and the one about how we're already, you know, we've already raised their rates and, you know, more than 50% over the last four seasons, which made me even more upset, to be honest with you. I think during union negotiations, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we used to teach a lot earlier in my career when unions were a bigger deal before Ronald Reagan busted the, you know, the air traffic controllers. You need to be transparent and honest about what's going on. Get the best information out to people, outline the company's position. You want to have open channels of communication with everyone so that employees can ask questions through multiple channels. You want to show respect and empathy for them, acknowledge their concern, and say, you know, we're doing the best that we can. We all have to be able to get through this. You don't want to have inflammatory language of the kind that they have. You want to collaborate with the union reps, find common ground. And then the most important thing is to train your managers and leaders so they can do a good job talking about sensitive topics like this without appearing dismissive or combative or coming at it from a legal perspective. Managers have to have the tools to be able to answer questions transparently and stay aligned with whatever the company messaging is. And look, we know that companies have to make money. There's no question about that. But when you see this amount of money and you find out that's what they're paying people, I think very few people are going to be sympathetic to the company. And they could have used a polling company like Morning Consult to figure out what people actually think and have realized this was in the atmosphere already. They did none of that, as far as I can tell.
Again, it's not like we saw, you know, a face of the company being proactive on even the local media, right, trying to explain, look, this is how we're trying. And again, that's something that I assume you would advise, right? You really have to get your, you have to have a spokesperson out there and somebody who is sort of expressing positive things. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is in situations like this, I was thinking, you know, why weren't they handing out free soda, free hot chocolate, or hiring acrobats and clowns, you know, doing something to sort of, I mean, have you seen other companies do things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it happens all the time. You have people waiting in line. I mean, I was in a line. I'm trying to think where we were in line, and somebody did that. They were passing out, you know, gifts to you to try to make you feel better. It's a common practice, but, you know, really what you want to be doing is maintaining regular updates to people, making sure people feel like they're safe and things are orderly. You want to maintain, you know, make sure that people understand that you really have a commitment to kind of get this resolved. And I think, as we're talking about right now, customers need to understand what the potential impact on service is and come up with solutions and alternatives of the kind that we talked about before, where you say we have a lot of other mountains where you can ski. And they obviously don't have a good public relations or communications team, either in-house or that they hire in, to explain the company's perspective without vilifying workers or the union. I mean, they must be just completely winging it. And if they do have a communications person or an outside agency, they did a terrible job and should be fired.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it almost sounds like their communication strategy itself was one of defense. Let's backpedal and cover it as it goes. It almost sounds that way.
And in the end, you know you're going, I mean, don't you know you're going to pay $2? They should have paid them the $7 they asked for, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, $28 for what those people do doesn't strike me as a ridiculous amount of money. And I mean, no, there's not going to be a whole lot of empathy for the company when they're not making their case for why they can't do that. It just seems like they're greedy and want to make more money for themselves, which may not be true. But how would we know, given how little communication we get from them? We don't know anything about their long-term goals. We don't know their understanding about how they want to create a positive work environment going forward. None of that. We have no idea what's going on.
Now, do you think this is something across corporate America, that they're letting the public relations side kind of, or public communication side kind of falter a bit? I've seen a little bit of that around.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, good.
I mean, I think there are a lot of good communication strategies and companies who have good communicators on board, managers who understand the importance of communication. You know, I've been teaching for 4 decades, and by now I would have thought it would be a whole lot better than it is, but it's way better than it was, you know, 40 years ago. And I'd say the appreciation and understanding of communication has grown dramatically. One thing I can tell you is that what typically happens after a situation like this is they get religion pretty quickly and will hire someone or hire a team. But they need help, and they need that help fast. And if they're getting it, they need to get rid of whoever has been doing that and call someone who can figure out how to communicate properly.
So if the senior Vail executives listening to this broadcast pick up the phone and call you and your phone rings and they say help, what kinds of things are you going to be talking about doing now? In other words, we talked about what they did before. We talked about what they did during. We're in the after period. One thing I have to point out is we here at KPCW we're trying to get, you know, a spokesperson from Vail to come out and talk about this. And so far, they haven't made anybody available. That is, as of the recording of this interview on January 15th. So if your phone rings, what are you going to tell them?
I mean, the first thing I would tell them is to apologize and apologize profusely to their customers about what happened and say, you know, we screwed up. We should have handled this differently. We should have handled both the negotiations differently, and we should have handled our customer relations in a tricky time differently. And, you know, that's the first and most important rule of crisis communication. And I do believe this is a crisis for Vail. Second, what you want to do is say, this is what we're doing to fix the situation. We're going to continue to work with our employees to try to make it better for them. This won't be the last raise we give them. And, you know, we have to work with the union, so it's a little bit tricky. It's not like we're dealing directly with our own employees. But I can assure you, we will not let this happen again. We'll do everything in our power to make sure it does not happen again, and that we, the union, and we are on the same page to avoid that. And I think that's what people want. They want to know what you're doing to fix the situation and that it will never happen again. Because I have to tell you, it's only, whatever, 4 weeks away from when I'm going out there. And, you know, I don't feel good about it. I honestly don't. And I think a lot of people, I've talked to other people who are going at the same time, are a little bit worried about this and how the company treats its customers and its employees does not make you want to spend a lot of time on that mountain in the future, or any of their mountains for that matter.
Can we talk about, assuming that they don't adopt that kind of strategy, or even if they do, let's talk a little bit about the half-life of the reputational damage we're talking about here. Is this something that's going to plague them for a while? What's your take on what you've seen other companies experience with similar kinds of damage?
Look, I think that the reality is that people have pretty short memories. And if they had a minor effort to try to fix this, they could get beyond it pretty quickly. And in addition, you know, people who like to ski like to ski. People who have houses there aren't going to stop going. People who've rented, you know, in the future are going to go. But the question is the next time, and this is, as a customer, I can tell you, the next time I will have second thoughts. And I'm sure that's true for anybody going on vacation. I mean, it is possible that people didn't hear about this, but I have to say this was widely reported. It was on NBC and NPR and a whole host of other places. You'd be hard-pressed not to have heard about this over the holidays. And given that, I do think it will have an effect on long-term relationships, and they need to fix that before it gets to that point. They really need to do something before they get there. And they have to have a different approach to communications overall going forward. If they can do that, it can be get beyond this pretty quickly. If they don't, more things like this will continue to happen. And I think the union is going to be emboldened because they know that mm-hmm. the empathy is on their side and not on the side of management. And that's going to have repercussions for the company.
Now, I know they have some resorts they manage in the Southern Hemisphere, so they can almost try out a few ideas with some of those on this upcoming summer.
Yeah, they could. And I think that would go a long way towards helping them. But not doing anything strikes me as a very dangerous situation for them to be in. And as I said at the top of the broadcast, to me, the best way to avoid problems like this is to never let them happen. If you can do that, you know, you're not going to have any problem. They did allow it to happen. They allowed it to get worse than it needed to get. And as a result, I do think there are going to be some repercussions for them.
Yeah, it's almost like what we teach our kids in the schoolyard, you know, use your words. Just talk if there's something going on. And that
would be nice. I haven't heard a lot of words from them. I don't know if you have, but I haven't heard much.
Not at all.
We've been speaking with Professor Paul Argenti of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
You're very welcome.
Our theme music was written by Parker Swenson and is performed by Swenson, David Becker, and Tony Ellison.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.